The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Ian Parker is an activist and academic, a revolutionary Marxist, and a practicing Lacanian psychoanalyst in Manchester. It's Wednesday, April 25th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, you might consider becoming a patron too. You'll get access to a second podcast every week, including installments of C. Derek Varn's podcasts, Symptomatic Redness, and Alternatives. The music you're listening to right now is the theme to A Bit of Fry and Laurie. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Ian Parker and I discuss revolutionary keywords. Ian Parker is an activist and academic, a revolutionary Marxist, and practicing Lacanian psychoanalyst in Manchester. He's involved in various political movements and has been for the last 40 years, and the author of two books for Zero Books, Psy Complex and Revolutionary Keywords for a New Left. And it's 50 essays. So how did you come to write these 50 essays for these words?
Well, it didn't originally start as a book. It started as a series of little pieces which were reflecting on the new kind of language that was appearing in the social movements. It's a different kind of language that you hear in the social movements than in the old left organizations. That is, the revolutionary organizations that look back to the 1917 October Revolution in Russia and trace their lineages back to that. The new social movements will use terms like performative, multitude, intersectionality, queer, and so on. And those terms are sometimes very strange and very unusual to the comrades in the old left organizations. So I wanted to explore what these new terms were doing, how they would work, and to explain them to my comrades in the other revolutionary organizations. And it's as I pieced them together that I started to realize that they should be in a book, that they should be collected together, and that they needed some kind of theoretical thread to understand how they'd emerged and how they operated.
You mentioned that the old vocabulary came from an old left, centered, and you mentioned it just now, but centered around the Russian Revolution and struggles in the 60s, and maybe specifically in 68. And this new language has developed since then. Has the terrain in which people are struggling changed? Are we having a different struggle now than we did in 1917? Or, I mean, if we can even say we about 1917, and are we having a different struggle now than we did? I think it's easier to say than we did when you're talking about 68 in the West. Has there been a shift in what we're battling about and what our struggles are for?
Yeah, I think there has been a shift. And I think that shift starts to appear in 1967, 1968. So what I do in the essay at the end of the Revolutionary Keywords book is to show how there are two 50-year periods of political development since 1917. The first period of political development from 1917 to 1967 is under the influence of the Stalinist bureaucracy in the Soviet Union and the regime in China. That is a very fixed idea of what Marxism is, that reduces Marxism to a kind of fantasy idea of the proletariat and of the leadership of the proletariat in Russia and China. And even the revolutionary organizations that pitted themselves against the bureaucracy in Russia and China, even those revolutionary organizations, usually from the Trotskyist tradition, even they operate as a kind of weird mirror image between of the bureaucracy between 1917 and 1967. They made a valiant effort to stand against the bureaucracy, but they repeat the language of the bureaucracy and a kind of fantasy obsession with the working class as the only axis of struggle, the only form of resistance against capitalism. Now, what happens in 1967, 1968 is that new social movements come onto the scene. We have the voicing of the anti-colonial, anti-imperialist movement, anti-racist movements, and of course, crucially, the emergence of socialist feminism. And socialist feminism puts on the agenda a new form of struggle against capitalism, which understands how capitalism is intertwined with patriarchy and heterosexism. And that opens the way for the new social movements that develop from 1967 in our last 50 years, the last 50 years of our revolutionary century. So what the new revolutionary keywords are doing, those new revolutionary keywords are interventions and forms of describing struggle that have emerged in the last 50 years. That's what I bring together and accumulate. They haven't emerged in the last 5 or 10 years, though some of them have, but that they have bit by bit emerged in the last 50 years.
There's this idea that what the left is doing, and I'm not sure where it comes from exactly, but I've heard rumor of this idea that what the left is struggling to find is a revolutionary subject. That we thought it was the proletariat, but because of the failures of the 20th century, because of the failures of the Soviet Union and China, we no longer have confidence that in the proletariat as being the revolutionary subject. And so now we're looking for new potential revolutionary subjects in order to carry on what we think of as a revolutionary struggle. Are these key words that describe a new revolutionary subject?
Well, I think you can read it in two ways. And to be honest, I'm really unsure which way is the correct way. But those two ways would be either to see these revolutionary keywords as naming a diversity of the revolutionary subject, which was always there in the proletariat, or naming a new revolutionary subject as such. And I think I prefer to go with the first option, actually, because that first option, that is, that they name the different facets of the revolutionary proletarian subject that was there, that made the Russian Revolution possible, and then the Chinese Revolution, and the Cuban Revolution, and the other rebellions against capitalism around the world, that what those struggles do is express the contradictions in the proletariat and the forms of struggle that make the proletariat something revolutionary. That is, forms of struggle that must include an attention to women's oppression, that must include an attention to sexual oppression, minority sexualities, that must include an attention to racism, and so on and so forth.
To what extent was the Chinese Revolution or the Russian Revolution a struggle against capitalism? I mean, my understanding is that it's that you might say that those were mixed economies, that you know, there was always the concern about what to do with the peasant classes because the capitalism hadn't fully developed in China and Russia. So is it fair to say that, I mean, it was certainly led by a party which thought of itself as representing the proletariat class, but were those revolutions truly against capital? I mean, they might be proletarian in character, but were they against capital per se?
I don't think they were only against capital. I mean, very clearly in the Russian Revolution in 1917, it was a revolution against feudal oppression. It was a revolution against the war, an inter-imperialist war that Russia had been drawn into. And the demands for freedom, for bread, were there as driving forces. And I don't think actually the Bolsheviks realized exactly what that revolution would look like in 1917. I think it's only after the event, after 1917, when you have a self-consciously developing Bolshevik party in power, that it can start to really theorize, reflect on what that revolution was about. What happens in the early years of the revolution after 1917 is there's a whole diversity of debate around art and culture and politics, which includes women's oppression and the dismantling of the family and so on. But that starts to close down in the 1920s so that the image of the Russian Revolution then starts to be fixated on the working class, an image of the working class. So if you like, the revolutionary keywords that we're starting to accumulate now, and there's more than 50, of course, there's just 50 in the book because I had to stop writing the thing.
Mm-hmm.
But those revolutionary keywords that are appearing in the last 50 years are also retrieving the memory of what was possible in those years around 1917.
What would you make of an argument from someone who is pro-capitalist? That's because I saw this in Reason magazine a few months back that would say that the biggest force that behind the liberation of women has been capitalist development. And that if you want to see, and if you want to really find the source of the changes that have emancipated women, what you need to look at is the way in which profit making has taken over the world. And that, you know, this was from a libertarian publication, which thought that capitalism was the greatest thing ever. But is there any truth in the idea that what was behind the destruction of the nuclear family was new demands for an expansion of, say, the proletariat class to include women and in the beginning, children, and that the destruction of agricultural ways of life and specifically maybe feudal ways of life or that relied more on a patriarchal structure, the disintegration of that way of life actually was something that was helpful to capitalist development. What would you make of that argument?
I think that on the one hand, you've got an emerging women's movement alongside the left through the 20th century, which is pushing demands for equality. And on the other hand, yes, you have got enlightened capitalists who can see a new niche market developing, who can see forms of audience for consuming new commodities, for bringing women into the workforce, that can take advantage of this emancipation of women. But what happens in that process is that women themselves become exploited in a different kind of way. That is, we see increasing objectification of women's bodies, something that is certainly as important now in 2018 as it was in 1968, if not worse. And you see what we could call a feminization of the workplace and of the marketplace, so that women's capacities for involvement are harnessed and turned into the part of the machinery of their exploitation and oppression. That is, I would say, first, you've got to look at where the drivers are for this liberation of women, and then you've got to look, and I think it's in the women's liberation movement, it's in the feminist movements, and it's in the left movements allying with them over the last 100 years. And then you've got to look at the way in which those who seem to speak out in favor of women are often hypocritical and are simply intent on reinforcing the distinctions between men and women and the power of men over women. That is, I don't think these libertarian arguments really stand up if you look at the way that the balance of forces plays out over the years.
On the objectification of women, are you talking about the commodification of the woman as an image that came about as means of marketing and media communication developed? Or do you mean as they entered into the labor market that their physical labor was objectified and alienated from them? Or do you mean both?
Yeah, I mean both. And I think there's a connection between the two.
You think there is? Okay.
What's the
connection between the objectification that we see and the commodification of the image of the woman and the expansion of the exploitation of women as they entered into the labor market?
I mean, the connection is, it comes through first of all, it comes in the kinds of employment the women are brought into in the new service sector after the 1960s.
After the 60s. Go ahead. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, sure. It comes into the kinds of employment that they're brought into. And that reinforces an idea of what a woman's natural abilities are. That she's able to be caring and intuitive. And in the same way that she's caring and intuitive in the family and does all of that kind of feeling and emotion work in the family, so she's more feeling, intuitive and caring in the workplace and is good at relating to customers. Is that kind of, account of feminization that you see in the work of the sociologist Arlie Hochschild, for example, who shows how women in the service sector have to engage in a kind of form of deep acting in which they present themselves as being good agents of the service sector. Air hostesses, for example, is the classic case studied by Arlie Hochschild, and that is a form of objectification of what women are, which reinforces the distinction between women and their natural capabilities and men and their supposedly natural capabilities.
Why is it that women historically were convenient for the capitalists to put into that role? What is it about the roles that women had before this development that set them up to be objectified in that manner, do you think? Is that a weird question? I mean, it's kind of an obvious one, right?
In some ways, it's a weird question, but it's not a bad question. I mean, I think it's to do with the ideology of the family that that was promoted for so many years through the 20th century.
So you're talking about religious ideology then, primarily before?
I think religious ideology is part of it, but you know, kind of consumerist ideology of the family presents women as the natural homemakers and men as the natural breadwinners. And that ideology of the family, in a way, covers over, you know, it presents itself as being natural and inevitable. It presents men and women as being suited to different kinds of emotional tasks and productive tasks, as if they've always been like that going back to the dawn of time. But actually what it does is cover over the participation of women in the workplace at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. If we look, for example, at the work in the factories in Manchester in the cotton industry in the 19th century, that is, you know, in the cradle of capitalism then you see massive participation of women in the workforce. Women were the main workers in the industry. And that participation is made invisible through the early years of the 20th century.
Insofar as machinery dispenses with muscular power, it becomes a means of employing laborers of slight muscular strength and those whose bodily development is incomplete, but whose limbs are all the more supple. The labor of women and children was, therefore, the first thing sought for by capitalists who used machinery. That mighty substitute for labor and laborers was forthwith changed into a means for increasing the number of wage laborers by enrolling under the direct sway of capital every member of the workman's family without distinction of age or sex. Compulsory work for the capitalist usurped the place not only of the children's play, but also of free labor at home within moderate limits for the support of the family. Footnote 38. Dr. Edward Smith, during the cotton crisis caused by the American Civil War, was sent by the English government to Lancashire, Cheshire, and other places to report on the sanitary condition of the cotton operatives. He reported that from a hygienic point of view, and apart from the banishment of the operatives from the factory atmosphere, the crisis had several advantages. The women now had sufficient leisure to give their infants the breast instead of poisoning them with the so-called Godfrey's cordial. They had time to learn to cook. Unfortunately, the acquisition of this art occurred at a time when they had nothing to cook. But from this we see how capital, for the purposes of its self-expansion, has usurped the labor necessary in the home of the family.
You mentioned how the kind of 50s styles, how I interpreted ideology around the family, tried to naturalize gender roles, and it papered over the fact that the Industrial Revolution relied on women's labor.
That's right.
Which is a really important point. One thing that's interesting to me is I've read Capital, Volume 1, far too recently, really. I should have read it many years ago, but and in it, Marx seems quite disturbed by women's labor, and not in a sexist way, but just because he sees women and children in the factory, he sees as destructive to the workers' private life and just to their life, because the hours were so long, the labor was so intense, and the kind of family life, which I think Marx took to be, if not natural, then preferable, to life in a factory, was disrupted. So the emancipation of women into the labor force was not, at the beginning anyway, the kind of emancipation that was obvious. I mean, I don't think it was lived as a felt emancipation, you know? It was lived as a hyper-exploitation.
Yeah.
It's only with the development of capital to a fairly high level that you can start to have work appear to be more liberating than domestic life.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a general point here, which is that forms of liberation are not always directly experienced as such. That is, when people are broken from old ways of living that they have got used to, sometimes those breaks are experienced as painful and destructive. You know, there's something about that human beings get used to certain ways of being in the world, including destructive, exploitative relationships. And when those old relationships are challenged and broken, it's a disturbing process. And I don't think it's surprising that Marx should show himself to be disturbed by this. He wasn't perfect and carried with him the kind of residues of patriarchal thinking and assumptions about the nature of human beings that would find their ways into his writings. So, you know, we've got a number of different things going on here that we can only understand now from our present vantage point. And as we understand those things now from our present vantage point, we have to be aware that things will be reworked and reinterpreted and understood in a different way in the next 50 years. You know, we look back at these debates in Capital, and we can start to see theoretical resources that we can make use of, but we also have to see the limits of those ways of articulating things that Marx was engaging in.
You said in your book that when you were describing the Marxist left, some groups in the 20th century thought that the party, the Revolutionary Party, was so important that they could immediately know and decide if there had been a revolution in another country. And it was as simple as this. If there had been a revolutionary leadership, there was a revolution. And if there hadn't been, if there was no party, there had been no revolution, which is a silly way to decide. How do you think we can judge whether or not there's been a revolution in any country, whether it's one's own or a foreign land? Deploying your maybe keywords or the concepts behind those keywords.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting question. And I think it relies on a theoretical understanding of what the nature of capitalism is, linked with a detailed exploration of what the experiences of people are when they've been challenging capitalism and challenging other forms of oppression. It's the link between the theoretical work and the practical work that is absolutely crucial here. And that's why the groups that made these stupid kinds of claims about the nature of revolution, you know, that there couldn't have been a revolution in Cuba, for example, because there wasn't a Trotskyist party at the leadership in Cuba. You know, the groups that made these stupid kind of evaluations are groups that are disconnected from the practice of the revolutions in those places. And I think it draws attention not only to the limits of the old revolutionary groups, mainly located in Europe and in some cases in US America, but it draws attention to the disconnection of these revolutionary activists from what's happening in other contexts. You know, the imposition of a model of revolution and reading everything that happens through that particular model of revolution.
Well, what do you think of this way of judging whether or not there's been a revolution in another country? If there's been a transformation in the mode of production, then there has been a revolution. In other words, if there's no longer wage labor, but there's another form that organizes people's collective work, then there's been a revolution.
If your understanding of capitalism is that it relies on the extraction of surplus value from the workers who are exploited in the workplace, then yes, a revolution must involve putting in place new kinds of social relationships where the economy doesn't rely on that kind of extraction of surplus value. In that kind of situation, you can say there's been a revolution, but the revolution happens through the conscious activity, this conscious self-activity of the working class and the oppressed as they experience what it was to have been exploited, and they experience the process of building something different.
Yeah, that's the need to put the control of the mode of production, I'll say, in a Marxist, framing, into the hands of the, not just the workers, but the people. And if you don't have self-conscious, active reflection and participation in a revolutionary process, then you don't have a revolution. I think that's true.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yes, absolutely.
I think it would be useful if we started by your telling me something about your state of mind at the moment. How would you describe it? Would you say you were happy or depressed, confident or unsure of yourself? What words would you use to describe your mood, would you say? Take your time.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Your problem seems to center around the delusion that you are a psychiatrist. And that everyone you speak to is a patient of some sort. This is a rare but not unheard of syndrome.
I think perhaps it'd be helpful now if we talked a little bit about your mother. What are your feelings towards your mother?
Extraordinary, really very intriguing. Now, why mother? Was your mother affectionate towards you when you were small?
Affection, that's interesting. I wonder why you chose that word particularly. I think it would be helpful if you told me at this point, if you can remember, whether or not you were breastfed as an infant.
Already you see we're focusing in on breasts. Good. Now, how do you feel about breasts now? Do they frighten you? Because again, this is quite common.
Breasts and fear. Oh, now that is very interesting. Breasts and fear. Fascinating association. Where do you think your father fits into that association?
Right. Absolutely classic father. All right, so let's imagine a line, shall we? We have fear at one end, breasts at the other. Now, where would you place your father on that line?
Lines. Now, that is interesting. I may ask you to draw those lines in a minute in something we call a Bender Gestalt test, which can be very revealing. But lines, let's explore those for a moment. They're very penetrative, aren't they? Very, very thrusting, very male, very masculine. They urge onwards, don't they?
Right. So now, at last, the layers are beginning to unpeel. This is very important. So we have breasts, we have fear, we have male, thrusting, penetrative, urging, some sort of psychiatric jargon you've picked up from the Reader's Digest. How often would you say you masturbated?
Now, I'm going to be really quite firm now, all right? I'm the doctor, you are the patient.
Yes, that's right.
Now, I'm sorry, I want to hear you say it. I want to hear you say, I am the patient.
What was that?
I am the patient.
Good. That's a breakthrough. Now that you can say that, now that you can admit it, we can proceed. Excellent.
Your other book with us, it was about psychoanalysis and the psi complex. So in that spirit, I thought I'd simply ask you to freely associate with your own keywords. Now, maybe that will mean that you just summarize or paraphrase some of the short essays you wrote, but maybe not. We'll see how it goes. But would you be willing to play that little game with me? I'll say the word, you respond to it.
Yeah, okay, give it a go.
So, identity.
Identity. Identity is a big thing here in Britain. I don't know how it is there in the States, but identity has become a kind of fetish for the old left, complaining about the emergence of new social movements. They complain that women are organizing around identity as women. They complain that gay people and lesbians are organizing around the identity of gays and lesbians. They complain that trans people are organizing around the identity of trans. And I think what's so interesting about identity is that the complaints and the fixation on identity are not so much in the new social movements, but they're in the activity of the old left that really is finding it difficult to grasp how important these new social movements are. The new social movements use the idea of identity of the oppressed in its manifold ways, but they use that idea of identity in a very tactical way. And even as they speak about identity, they challenge it. They challenge the way that they have been identified. They challenge the way that they have been categorized by forms of power. And so I think that so-called identity politics is a kind of mirage. In actual political practice, there's as strong a movement against identity as there is in favor of it. And I think we've got to break through this deadlock between the old left that doesn't like identity and keeps complaining about it, and the new social movements who are actually much more canny and much more fluid in the way that they approach forms of oppression and the way that they think about who they are.
Okay. Intersectionality.
And intersectionality is the other side of the coin, really. Intersectionality is treated by some of the old left as being an accumulation of different sectional interests. Whereas what intersectionality does is to show the interrelationship between oppression by capitalism and patriarchy, heteropatriarchy and racism, and to explore the ways in which people are located at the intersection, or they're located at the meeting point of those different forms of oppression and exploitation. That is, intersectionality is a way of grasping and acting against how we are separated into our different identities as workers and women and gays and lesbians and trans and black activists and so on and so forth. Intersectionality is a way of, actually, if anything, is a way of uniting the different fragments of the exploited and oppressed. Very useful term.
Whiteness.
Whiteness is something that white activists find it difficult to see. And I'm speaking as a white guy myself. And the only way I can see my whiteness and the way that it works in practice is by reading the writings and working alongside the activists from the black movements. They show me how my world is structured as a white world, and how it excludes and screens out the experiences of black people. Whiteness is an invisible form of oppression for many of us white folk, but it has to be spoken about in order to draw attention to the privilege that we have in this world and the ways in which our forms of theory repeat certain assumptions about the privilege that should be given to the West over other parts of the world, for example.
This is so easy to do interviews this way. Young girl.
Oh, young girl is a fantastic one. Young girl is the fantasy about femininity, the fantasy that the young feminine subject is the perfect consumer of capitalism, and the fantasy among some on the left that the young feminine subject is the perfect subject of resistance. That is an idealization of femininity that repeats the worst of patriarchal ideology. In some cases, activists try to reclaim it. And in the Revolutionary Keywords book, I home in on the activities of the Femen movement, the ways in which the Femen movement interrupt kind of like meetings of kind of white patriarchal guys, but the ways in which the Femen movement actually repeats that idealization of young young women and falls straight into the trap of patriarchal ideology.
I'm going to play a clip here of a comedian on YouTube who will take news footage of the Femen protests and go, "Oh, these are my kinds of feminists."
Radical feminists were getting the baps out again for another juicy protest. Who knows what it was about, but they ran away looking very nice.
Spirituality.
I find spirituality a very difficult one because I was brought up as an atheist, which is very unusual in Britain. We usually kind of like a default position for most folk here is that they're brought up in the Church of England and think of themselves as being Christians. And as we start to kind of work alongside different groups from different parts of the world in the revolutionary movement, we start to learn that spirituality isn't only a machinery of oppression. It isn't only to do with the power of the church as institutionalized religion, but we start to learn how spirituality is absolutely crucial to some of the movements of the oppressed in Latin America, for example, where liberation theology becomes fused with Marxism, and the struggle between good and evil is seen as a struggle between actually existing capitalist exploitation, that is evil, and the collective potential progressive and constructive activity of human beings working together in the world, that is the side of good. Good and evil are here in the world in this version of spirituality, and it's something that we need to take seriously and work with if we're going to understand how different forms of resistance are starting to emerge in different parts of the world.
Finally, postmodernism.
Postmodernism is that thing that the old left love to hate. It's the thing which disrupts their guiding narrative of historical progress, the guiding narrative that holds their understanding of Marxism together. Marxism as a kind of big enlightenment project that will bring enlightenment to the whole of the world along with the revolution. What postmodernism does is to disrupt and fragment that big narrative and to open the way for thinking about other forms of oppression. Now, yes, some forms of postmodernism will dissolve everything into language and lose sight of the material conditions for those different forms of oppression. And it's not surprising that there should be those forms of postmodernism. Everything can be recuperated, absorbed, and neutralized and caricatured by capitalism in order to reinforce its power. But there is a revolutionary postmodernism as well. And that revolutionary postmodernism is a kind of postmodernism that brings out the best of the Marxist tradition. The best of the Marxist tradition is alive to the contradictoriness of oppression and alive to the contradictoriness at the heart of every individual subject who lives under capitalism today.